Welcome to the Freshman 15, a film discussion podcast where we focus on the freshman works of 15 notable directors.
Here's what we do. Each episode, we talk about a different freshman film, what's good, what's bad, what themes and stylistics the director went on to use in later films, and what they might have kicked to the curb.
Also, we'll give you our opinion on whether the film still stands up, if it ever did, or if it's for completists only.
I'm Daniel Long, and sometimes I stay awake at night wondering if I'm a gutless wonder.
And I'm Jeremy Baer, and if I had one piece of advice for the class of 2016, it's this. Wear sunscreen. And if you don't know why that's clever, then I just feel bad for you.
So, I heard we have mail.
We do have mail. We actually had some interesting reactions to American Beauty, episode 4.
And why wouldn't we?
It was hard to tell whether or not we were being too hard on it. I had feedback from more than one person, and this made me feel bad. People that said, I thought I really liked that movie, and then you told me why I guess I don't.
I had someone say, you know, I watched it recently, and I think you're right. It's not as good as I thought it was.
Yeah, I felt like we're like Mrs. Deagle in Gremlins. We just go around ruining Christmas for people.
Wow, a Gremlins reference.
Yeah,
that's
good. I don't know. It may be a while before we get to Joe Dante episode of Freshman 15, but whatever.
So I had a friend who texted me and said, "Don't screw with my movie," talking about American Beauty.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and then she said she listened to the podcast and enjoyed it. But since she wanted, we needed to talk about it. We needed to have a conversation.
All right. Well, you know what? Hey, listen, open invite. If you have something you want to say, even here on the podcast, come on down, brother or sister. I don't know who it is.
Right.
We'll have you. We'll let you speak your piece. But there was one piece of mail that we received that I thought was pretty good. One listener writes, "Hey, Frosh, your American Beauty episode is my favorite so far. Definitely enjoyed the seething rage and occasional begrudging compliments of the movie. You should pick movies you dislike more often. Listening to your interpretation of Lester as a self-absorbed asshole, which I sort of agree with, I think there's an alternate universe where the movie kinda agrees with you. Follow me here. You got the story about an average whiny American middle-aged douchebag. You follow him the whole movie long, getting slowly angrier as he regresses. And when he hits his moment of absolute perfect self-absorption, he gets shot in the brains. Like he has his big moment of revelation, and the universe said, fuck it, he's gone as far as he's ever going to get, boom. And even in death, he seems to regard his living self as pretty obtuse, so maybe that's what he was getting at the whole time. I mean, probably not. That movie was pretty self-satisfied, but let's think positive, right? One question, what happens when you guys hit 15 episodes? You pack it up, do a second season of another 15, start a new show called Sophomore Slump. Thanks, y'alls. And that is from John Nelson. And by the way, before, because I want to address John Nelson's comments. Thank you, by the way, John, so much.
Thank you so much. So sweet, John, taking the time to write us.
It was really cool. We really appreciate it. But I want to take a second to mention John Nelson, because he has a podcast of his own with his co-host John Longinot, and the name of that podcast is The Holdup. And if you're not currently listening to The Holdup, you absolutely have to, because it's fantastic. The premise of their podcast is they take movies that they remember fondly and they watch them now years later, and they discuss whether or not that film holds up. It's really, really, their chemistry is great. The
it's
podcast
so good.
Is.
I've listened to it. Yeah. That first episode, the last Starfighter episode.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Anyhow, listen to The Holdup. But thanks again, John, for writing. Making some solid points about American Beauty.
Absolutely.
I think we even acknowledged at the time that no, nothing really works out for too many characters, so maybe that counts as a critique of the philosophies as American Beauty. I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, one of the things that his email does raise, even if people are maybe getting angrier and angrier at Lester, I think the question remains, does the film want you to get angrier and angrier at Lester? Or is it kind of rooting for him?
When I read what he had to say, I actually thought of the film, which is a similar name, American History X. Do you remember American History X? Was that a freshman film? It may have been. It was such an interesting thing because, you know, you track with this character who's, you know, the Ed Norton character, he's such an asshole. He's this racist asshole. And he's making all these statistical arguments. He's this charismatic guy and stuff. And then at the end of the movie, he turns into like this guy who's enlightened, but he's demure and boring. And I'm just like, well, yeah, I mean, clearly racism is bad, but why did you have to make racism look so freaking awesome?
I know.
You know, I mean,
right, exactly. why was racism so much fun?
Yeah.
In, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel the same way about American Beauty. It's like, okay, yeah, maybe you're making that point, but why spend so much of your time like trying to show like how cool it is to be such a dick?
I know. That's Lester. We're going back to Lester. Yeah. But you can relate to him.
Yeah. But anyway, I do want to address the other question from John.
He says, what happens next?
Yeah, what happens next? Now, the question that I get the most, Daniel, is what happens after 15?
Oh, yeah, I get that question all the time. I feel like we're even asking ourselves that question all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a good answer for that. I don't know. I mean, I'll be fully transparent about this. Part of the reason that we chose the name The Freshman 15 wasn't just because it was like a clever way to work the word freshman into the title. It also forced us to commit to 15 episodes, which, you know, we're like, well, what if we get bored with this and hate it after 4 episodes?
We're in it. We're in it for 15.
We, you know, hell or high water, we're doing 15. But, you know, what I didn't expect is for us to actually enjoy it as much as we do.
Really? You didn't think you'd...
Well, I didn't know. I mean, you know, I thought, it's a lot of work putting these things together, so I didn't know.
Well, it's a lot of work for you. I just bring the beer and myself, really.
Yeah, but I love it, and I don't know. It's a good question. By the way, if you've got, if you're listening and you have opinions about whether or not we should continue or if we should continue in a different form or we should just completely disregard the idea of 15, tell us what you think.
Really, the future might be riding on your opinion.
If our stats hit a certain number.
Oh, wow. Okay. Throwing out the fleece.
Well, anyhow, that being said, I don't know. What do you say? You want to get into
it? Let's do it.
You won't admit you love me. And so, how am I ever to know? You always tell me.
So usually, Jeremy, we start out the episode and we give a little synopsis talking about the plot of the film.
Right.
But I want to start out with a confession.
I'm ready.
This is the first time I've seen this film.
Really?
No, I thought I had seen this film before.
And you hadn't.
And I started watching it and realized I've never seen this film before.
Wow.
And I wanted to save this for the podcast.
Yeah.
This is the first time you're hearing about this.
Well, this is a reveal because you represented to me that this was something that you had seen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, and let's not leave everyone in the dark. Of course, the movie in question and the director in question, of course, is Baz Luhrmann's Strictly Ballroom.
And it's Baz. That's what we're going to say.
We're going with Baz.
Okay, so Baz from now on.
Short for Basil, maybe?
I don't think so. I actually read that his original name was Mark Anthony.
Oh.
And his dad called him Baz. And so he legally changed his name.
Well, for somebody who's never seen Strictly Ballroom, you seem to know quite a bit about old Baz.
He's a good-looking guy. Have you seen the way he dresses?
Oh, you're telling me.
He's so awesome.
He's got that sort of like gray flavor in his hair. It's just...
It's great hair.
It's a good head of hair on Baz. And by the way, never let it be said that we don't heed the call. This is actually, believe it or not, our very first listener-requested episode.
More than one listener.
More than one listener. The listeners that go by the name of Carrie, Diana, and Layla, all three said you need to do a Baz Luhrmann episode. So ladies, this one's for you.
It is. All right, so Strictly Ballroom. Do you want to do the synopsis? You want me to do it?
Sure, I don't mind. I kind of got a taste for it last time.
All right.
So Strictly Ballroom, the freshman film of Baz Luhrmann, Australian director. Needless to say, the entire film takes place in Australia, but it centers around a couple different characters. One, of course, is a ballroom dancer named Scott Hastings, championship dancer, and it's clear that he's got his whole future ahead of him in the world of ballroom dancing. And of course, the newbie, Fran, who just wants to dance with Scott. And there's a lot of different drama about whether or not who he'll dance with as his dance partner. He wants to dance his own steps. And, well, everything escalates. There's a love story until finally we see the culmination of the whole thing at the Pan Pacific competition, and we see just how everything pans out.
It's a great synopsis.
High energy film.
really high energy. I mean, right from the get-go, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you already answered this question. When did you first see the film and how did it hit you? And you're saying you just saw it.
I just saw it. So I just saw it this week in preparation for this podcast.
Well, I mean, at this point, I don't want to assume anything. Have you seen other Baz Luhrmann films?
I've seen all of Baz Luhrmann films except for Australia.
What was your impression of Strictly Ballroom?
So initially, I could tell right off the bat it was a Baz Luhrmann film. Well, because I'd gone into this film, right, having seen his other films, and I think the ones that made the biggest impression on me, Romeo and Juliet, Moulin Rouge, of course, and the one I've seen most recently is The Great Gatsby. And you can tell there's this frenetic energy in all of his films, the editing, the close-ups on the face. The thing that surprised me about Strictly Ballroom is how much things like that annoyed me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's a certain sense in which I don't think I realize this with the other films, so it's true to the other films. There's a constant sense of Baz wanting the audience to remember that they're the audience.
Hmm.
He's trying to remind you constantly that you are watching a film. And I think he shares that in common with Tarantino.
Hmm.
And both of these filmmakers actually... there's a love and hate relationship with regard to that.
Yeah.
Because I love films that kind of draw me in where I kind of forget that I'm a part of the story. I forget that the film is actually going on. But then when these directors come along, Baz and Tarantino, there's a certain level in which I'm like, okay, this is cool. This is great. I really appreciate the energy, the techniques, and they seem really obvious. But then there's a certain level at which I kind of feel like it's tiresome.
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying, because certainly when you're talking about a very stylized approach, sometimes that can come that has the effect, wanted or unwanted, of keeping the audience at arm's length.
You might know more about this, but I heard that his first three films, so that would be Strictly Ballroom, Romeo and Juliet, and Moulin Rouge, are part of what he's coined Red Curtain Cinema.
Yeah, the Red Curtain Trilogy.
The Red Curtain Trilogy. So do you think that is have you read anything about that where that's intentional to that style of filmmaking where he's actually wanting to keep the audience at length? Like, is there a certain level in which he's creating film for that purpose?
The shorter answer is I do think it is. I think not necessarily arm's length, although I think he probably doesn't mind that. Well, let me back up for a second. My impression of it is tied into my first experience with it. When Romeo and Juliet came out, it is not overstating to say I was obsessed with Romeo and Juliet by Baz Luhrmann. I mean, it was at the time I was in a student production. I was acting in a student production of Midsummer Night's Dream. To go to the theater and see Shakespeare presented this way while I was in the middle of learning my own Shakespeare lines was a real bolt from the blue. I never conceived that Shakespeare could be done this way.
So immediately connected with you.
Immediately connected with me. My girlfriend who's, you know, my wife, Carrie, we decided this was our movie.
Oh, that's awesome.
She came down the aisle to Kissing You, which is the theme song from Romeo and Juliet and the whole thing. I mean, we were just absolutely so bananas for the film. It was the color, like you say, it was the editing.
Right.
It was the editing more than anything. But the performances, it was something, it just felt so modern. And I remember looking at it and thinking, this is something that's going to set some sort of precedent. This is going to be how a lot of films are made now because of this. And I felt like it was that important. And I remembered seeing Romeo and Juliet and hearing, you know, from the guy who did Strictly Ballroom. And of course, I wanted to know, okay, well, what other film is like this? At that time, there was only Strictly Ballroom. I don't remember how soon after Romeo and Juliet I went and saw Strictly Ballroom, but I did.
With Carrie?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. But I remember renting it and watching it and expecting to like it, and it met my expectations. I won't say it exceeded it. I do remember thinking at the time, well, this is sort of in terms of the energy and the color and the style, it's sort of a diet version of that style.
Right.
I've revised that opinion. I think it has its own energy. That's just definitely a Baz Luhrmann energy. This was a voice that we would be hearing a lot from, and this was going to be a really, really important filmmaker in years to come. I mean, here we are, and of course, you know, Strictly Ballroom, that was 1992.
Right.
You know, and in all this time, this is, we're going on 24, 25 years here. Yeah. And he's made 5 films. So
which is so surprising.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Now, of course, he's currently most involved with his Netflix series, The Get Down, which is as Baz Luhrmann a thing as I've ever seen.
I've only seen one episode.
It was the first episode then, which is the one that he directed.
Right.
And it is completely him, all the themes that he likes. And so you mentioned the red curtain. I think there's 2 ways to look at that. I think, number one, all of those movies open with red curtains opening, you know, so you know, whatever. But there is something, though. There's something. So the history of Strictly Ballroom, it started as a stage production.
That I knew.
Yeah. I think you feel it. To a certain degree.
Yeah, you do.
What's interesting to me, though, and this was a surprise, this is something I didn't even realize until I was researching the film for this, that stage production was actually an improv'd show.
Oh, the actual production.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, they made a comment about the fact that, like, when they wanted to turn it into a movie, one of the potential investors asked to see the script of the original play, and he sort of gave him a few pages of scrawled notes. He was like, okay, but where's the script? He's like, oh, no, this is it. Yeah. And it, because the show was, you know, improvised in a lot of ways. And so, which is so interesting because it seems like not that kind of a thing. Like, how could you improvise that?
Absolutely. Especially,
the dance moves.
How would you do that?
I don't know. Maybe the dance steps weren't, but the dialogue, I don't know how they did it. Baz Luhrmann, who, by the way, never went to film school.
Right.
He was just a guy who had ambitions about, you know, he was thinking about the stage, and he was thinking about costumes and lights and situations and all these kinds of things. And film was just one more thing that he thought would be kind of a cool way to tell the story. It's a really amazing, though, too. I mean, you look at a director like Baz Luhrmann with that specific a voice, and just the idea that film was something, was kind of like an also job for him.
Absolutely. He's like, I could do this.
Yeah.
I mean, he grows up, I did read some about his background, and his mom was a ballroom dance teacher.
Right.
And his dad worked at a gas station and also ran a local theater. Mm. So he was around this world of art and performance. But to think that that would translate into film and to do it, and that we talked about this before, like if it's your freshman film, it's a go big or go home situation.
Oh, yeah.
That I do think he succeeds in with Strictly Ballroom is, and I didn't think about this until you were talking about, until we've started talking about the audience. But in this film, there's a lot of audience actually in the film itself. Mm. I just think that's fast. It's part of his world. It's what he knows how to translate into cinema.
Yeah, and it's a side note, which is kind of interesting about the audience. The final scene with the big Pan-Pacific competition, they knew they needed an audience. I don't know if you heard this.
No, I don't know.
So they actually went to a major ballroom competition. I can't remember if it was in Sydney or Melbourne. They got permission to film their scenes on the lunch hour.
No way.
Yeah, like they took like an hour intermission, you know, so that people could eat. And that's when they shot, I mean, really not the entire scene, but the scenes, the wide shots where you could see the audience and those kinds of things. So, and what was interesting is if you see some of the shots, the audience is extremely sparse. And in other shots, the audience, it looks pretty full.
I did notice that, right.
And the reason is because no one gave a damn about being in this movie. And so as soon as they started shooting, people were just like, oh, screw it. And they got up. But yeah. And they started leaving. So he was just trying to cram in as many shots as he could. It did get to a point to where it was too sparse to even use. So they ran around and they started putting shirts and dresses on chairs. And, you know, which they hoped would look like people in them out of focus. And
that's incredible.
Yeah.
They just did what they could.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, that should tell you something about the money that they had to put this together.
Right.
And, you know, and the cachet that Baz Luhrmann had at that point, which was to say zero. And, but, you know, they were still able to make this pretty grand spectacle of this ending scene.
And it couldn't be more different now. I mean, he can almost get anything he wants, it seems like, at least in the grand spectacle of what he's wanting to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. He's still, though, a very polarizing figure.
Why do you think that is?
Here's something I didn't really understand when I had my Romeo and Juliet obsession going on, was in my youth, I didn't understand how you could see a movie like that and not just completely be in love with it. I mean, it was just so It was so grand.
I had a similar experience with Romeo and Juliet. My mind was blown by that film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just seemed like it had everything. It was hilarious, and it was heartbreaking, and it was just, it had color and great performances, and of course, you know, the Shakespearean script, and it was intellectually stimulating, and it was everything layer on layer on layer. And a lot of people were like, meh, it was a little much, you know? Totally. And I couldn't understand that. I look at it now, I do understand it.
Yeah.
I completely get it. Now, I still love that film. I think it's as impressive now as it's ever been, really. Very bold. But I get why you have Baz Luhrmann people and non-Baz Luhrmann people. It is a lot to mm-hmm. take in. And I think what you pointed out at the beginning, I can understand why that's not necessarily a turn on for people.
The thing is when it works, it's amazing. When it works for me, right? I think there's a level which it's working all the time in the way that he wants to. When I feel like I'm willing to go where he's wanting me to go, that it's an amazing experience. But when I feel like I want something different, or I'm kind of ready for something different, that's when I almost feel like reactionary, or no, I don't think I want to, I kind of want something else. But here's the thing about Baz Luhrmann, is that there are moments and there are elements that you care about that you don't think you would ever care about.
Yeah.
And like, I'm thinking the dancing.
Yeah.
Like I know you're a great dancer.
Yeah, sure.
But I'm not. And so I never thought about caring about ballroom dancing, but then you are rooting for these people to dance well, and you want them to do these steps, and you want them to do that spin move, and you hear the whoosh every time he does that spin move.
Yeah.
I found myself caring in these moments where I'm like, why do I care?
Especially now in this culture, there's a whole genre of dance movies, you know, of people that are casting off their inhibitions and dancing. And that's the catalyst for so many movies. And I'll be honest with you, most of these movies, I can't stomach. I know there's good ones and bad ones.
Right.
But it's become such a cliche. And like, you know, the out-of-towner comes in and teaches a bunch of ragamuffins to love life again because, by God, they're going to dance. And I don't care.
Dancing stands in for this freedom, right? This is this, yes, they can break free from these old stale ways.
Yeah, and they want to try and convince me that the town's traditional assholes are so invested in making sure that no one dances, but they're going to buck the system and they're going to dance and they're going to show them all. And I never buy it. But man, I buy it for some reason with Strictly Ballroom. You know what I mean? When there's a moment at the end where Scott's father is finally being truthful with him about his own dance career, right, and why it went down the tubes. He says, don't you see that it wasn't about winning. It was about the dancing. And, you know, just by itself, a line like that, I'm like, you've got to be freaking kidding
me. Right.
But in that moment, I would, you know, I've got tears rolling down my cheeks saying, yes, Scott, don't you see that it's about the dancing?
It's about the dancing.
I feel I'm in it. Baz Luhrmann did a thing where, you know, the son of a bitch invested me in this idea that it's about the dancing.
And I feel that way too, because I feel that in those moments when he, there's that whole sequence when he's with Fran's family. And are they, what are they? Greek? Spanish? What?
Spanish, right?
Okay, Spanish. You know, they're doing the pase doble. Yeah, pase doble. And he does it, and they just all hug.
Yeah.
Right? Like he's completed the dance moves, and it's like he just cured cancer.
Yeah.
And they're all hugging, or he, you know, against all odds.
Oh, yeah.
And he's really made it, and I'm thinking, yes.
Yeah.
You did it, Scott.
And in contrast, when he's doing a respectable but stiff version of the pase doble, it's, what a silly man he must be to think that that was the pase doble.
Yeah, and where do you feel it, right? And then you have the grandmother just tapping on the chest.
Rum-da-da-dum-da-da-dum-da-rum-dum-dum-da-da-dum.
And then that reminds me of the moment when they're doing the sequence where he's teaching Fran, right? And it's the beautiful shot on top of the building, right, where they're dancing in front of the Coca-Cola sign, which is so beautiful. I mean, if you're going to do product placement, do it that way, right? So good.
I know. And do you know that Coke wasn't really even on board with that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's true. They finally were able to milk some money out of Coca-Cola in order to be able to have that sign there, but, you know.
But in that moment, all of a sudden, you know, Cyndi Lauper, Time After Time comes on, and I'm like, Son of a bitch, I feel something.
You do?
Why do I feel something? This song, it's time after time.
Time after time.
Yes.
Time after time. Another song we had in our wedding because of Baz Luhrmann.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, you had a Baz wedding.
It was a Baz wedding. I'm not going to lie to you.
It's amazing. Wow. I want to see those photos. So I guess a question I have is, you know, he takes these elements. In Strictly Ballroom, it's dance. In Romeo and Juliet's language, Moulin Rouge, you have song. And he uses these elements to kind of bring you in on a different level.
Right.
The comment I made before about audience participation, because those three elements, at least, they do cause you to participate. I mean, I remember in each of these films, and this one, Strictly Ballroom, wanting to participate in that level of like, I want to root for him in that dance. I don't know nothing about dance, but I want him to do that, you know?
Yeah.
In Romeo and Juliet, like, I want the language to continue. Never does it get old.
Right.
That they're talking in Shakespearean language. And in Moulin Rouge, I remember listening to that soundtrack over and over after the film.
Lady Marmalade.
Right, absolutely. So what is it about those things, or what is he tapping into that kind of brings us into the films in that way?
In my opinion, the thing that can be seen as a weakness of Baz Luhrmann is actually a strength. This theatrical, heightened reality, this sort of stylized approach that, yeah, I guess maybe it does kind of keep you at arm's length, but at the same time, it's also the vehicle for the sermon that I guess Baz is preaching us. This sort of gets into what are the common elements of Baz Luhrmann's work. And we had our Sam Mendes episode. We were saying, like, you know, well, what's the common thing? And it's a little tougher because it's like, I don't know what the things are that hold his work together. But I would say Baz Luhrmann is the other extreme, where it's like every single thing in all of his films, whether it's thematics or whether it's visuals or approach or style of acting, everything is a Baz Luhrmann film. And it takes you 20 seconds to be like, there could be no other director for a film like this, because he's such a specific style. I think those themes in all of his movies, he loves the idea of the star-crossed lovers that can't be together for some societal or familial reason, and yet they have to be.
Yeah.
They know that it can't work, but by God, they're going to make it work.
Every single one of his films.
Every single one of his films has, to a degree, a person who is driven to discover and act out their passions in some way. And they're going to buck society, and they're going to go against the advice of all those around them to find that passion. And that was true with Strictly Ballroom, every single movie, all the way into The Get Down. It's in every single thing he's ever done. He loves this idea that art and passion are these things that you're only doing right if you're doing it in a way that's rebelling against all the ways you're supposed to do things.
Right, and I love that. I love that about Strictly Ballroom, is that here you have this dance film, and through it, he's almost making a commentary on maybe this particular style of filmmaking and how it might be perceived or not. So you have these rules that he probably is aware of cinematically. He knows he's also breaking them. He wants to do his own thing. In his mind, or whether or not he's actually heard it, there are the Barry Fifes, who, if you don't know, in Strictly Ballroom, Barry Fife is the guy who's actually the main judge or overseeing the different dances and making sure that things are to regulation.
Sure.
So in the Barry Fifes of the world, you know, he's imagining what their criticisms are going
to
be.
I understand that Les has lined you up with Tina Sparkle. Well, don't blow it, son, because if you don't start listening to your teachers and superiors, there won't be a mark on the scorecard low enough for you at the Pan Pacific, comprende?
Barry's only thinking of your well-being.
Where do you think we'd be if everybody went around making up their own steps?
Out of a job.
And so here you have, and I love that about this film. Like, oh, he's making a commentary on his way of wanting to do film. That's an interesting question about art. What is that line between following quote-unquote rules and then breaking those rules for originality? When do you do that successfully? And I think that he does it in this film, where he's successfully breaking some rules.
Yeah.
But then you can see other filmmakers who try to do something and it just seems really ridiculous and silly.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's no shortage of people who are saying, I'm going to do my own thing and, you know, the world be damned. and they make the most asinine, forgettable thing, you know, the world has ever seen.
In every medium.
Sure. Yeah, without a doubt. What's really interesting is Baz Luhrmann himself has said in interviews and commentaries and things that the story of the making of Strictly Ballroom and the financing of it and getting it up on the screens and getting it to Cannes and all those kinds of things is the same story as the story that's in Strictly Ballroom, which was it was a story of just refusing to listen to people who seem to have the right way to do things. People that seem to have perfectly good sense were telling them, that's just not really the way it's done. You kind of are supposed to go about it this way and that way, and you're kind of supposed to do this and that. And you have Baz Luhrmann and his, you know, band of ragamuffins saying, well, but that doesn't make sense to us. Right. It makes sense to us to do this. I mean, they drew it as a comic book, this whole movie. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it's not one that they ever published. It's just they drew this comic book, and it was a way to take it around to people to say, see, it's kind of like this.
Oh, wow.
So it's just, it was so interesting, you know, that, I mean, who thinks to get financing for a movie that way? But Baz was like, I don't know, how can we put, you know, he was looking at, like, you know, typed screenplays and saying, there's nothing passionate about this. How right. am I supposed to sell a movie like Strictly Ballroom to a financier with a typed document? No, he wanted to show them the color and the passion
yeah.
and the art of what it could possibly be, and that seemed to be the medium to use.
Yeah, and I think that those faces, right, that he has in all of his films, you can't, you know, on a script, you can't see the close-up of Scott's mother, you know, in the very opening shots of the film, yelling, go 100, go 100, right? And yelling, her face changing when she's realizing he's making up his own steps. Yeah, you can't see that on a script. It's really fascinating. You did that by comic book.
Yeah, and it's something that, like I said, I don't think he ever published it or anything like that, but it just, it got the job. It got him what he needed to get out of it. And it also speaks to Baz Luhrmann's ability to inspire people. And by right. the way, you can't really make a film like the films that he makes with just, you know, with a good script. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to have people that surround you that are, frankly, willing to die for you mm-hmm. in order to make a piece of art like that.
And to take the different risks that he takes with, you know, we're going to make a musical. No, we're going to actually use Shakespeare's language. No, we're going to make a movie set in the 20s and we're going to use Jay-Z as part of the soundtrack.
Definitely thematics, but are there other areas that we can see that, yes, this is clearly a Baz Luhrmann film?
There seems to be a large cast of characters, supporting yeah. characters. And I think that that's something that I see in all of his films. That you have two main characters, but then you have this whole array of characters around them that maybe they may not highlight different parts of the character, but it's their presence that then, because of who the actors or actresses are needing to respond to, you see different parts of them. And I see that in all of his films. I mean, in this film you have the mother and the father and the judge and the teacher and Fran and her parents and they're not just minor characters. They actually they play a major role in the story. And it's the same with Romeo and Juliet. You have that in Moulin Rouge, and certainly you have that in Great Gatsby. There's this whole array of characters that I see all throughout that he uses to great effect to show. To reveal something about the two main lovers of the film.
Baz Luhrmann doesn't seem to know how to make a small story.
Right.
Every story that he does is big mm-hmm. and sweeping and glorious. You know, it's strange to talk about Baz Luhrmann in the same context as, say, Noah Baumbach or something right. like that, who doesn't really seem to know how to make a big movie, you know? And that's to both those directors' mm-hmm. credits, because you're going to get a certain kind of story out of Baz Luhrmann, and it's going to be big and sweeping. And Baz Luhrmann has this way. He makes you decide up front whether or not you're going to cast off your own cynicism. Because if that's something that you can't do, then you just need to know in advance right. this movie's not for you. If you have any cynicism whatsoever, you're just going to have a hard time. And if you decide you're in, man, he's going to reward you.
Yeah.
If you can decide that, all right, I'm going to buy this idea that ballroom dancing is the most important thing I've ever done, then he's going to reward it. And I think that is something that's missing from a lot of these kinds of movies, like, you know, these dance movies or something, because movie producers and directors know that they're dealing with cynical, shitty bloggers and critics that are looking for reasons to tear things down and all that. And so they feel the need to wedge things into their movies that are like, okay, well, you know, we gotta show that we're not taking ourselves too seriously. So let's introduce a character who's kind of making fun of everything. And Baz Luhrmann says, no, I'm not doing that. You're either in or you're out. And if you're in, man, oh man, I'm gonna take you all the way.
And there's a certain level of sincerity in that. And that's one of the things I do love about Baz Luhrmann, this film in particular, having not seen it before, is he's owning who he is, the stories he wants to tell, and the way in which he wants to tell them. And you see that in all of his films. It reminds me of this short story author. Maybe I've mentioned him on this in one of our episodes, George Saunders, my favorite short story author. But he said when he was writing, he suffered from what he calls the Hemingway boner, where he just was so wanting to be Hemingway that he could never write anything that he was actually proud of, because it never measured up to this person he was trying to be like. Mm. And then over time, he realized, okay, well, here's Hemingway's mountain or hill. And I've tried so much to climb that and have failed every time. You know what? Here's my little pile of shit right here, but I can get to the top of it every time. And it might not look like Hemingway's, but it's going to look like mine. Mm. And it's going to be great, and it's going to be meaningful, because it's who I am and what I love to do. And I think about that with Baz, is he's not actually trying to be like anyone else.
No.
You can't look at a Baz film and be like, you know what, he really tried to be like this person, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
He's trying to be himself all the way, telling the stories he wants to tell, and in the way he wants to tell them. And I think, I mean, I just give the guy credit for that.
Yeah.
I love that.
If you want to find a director that no doubt about it has drunk his own Kool-Aid, Baz Luhrmann definitely. I mean, even by virtue of the fact that we hear the same phrase repeated again and again throughout the movie, a life lived in fear is a life half lived. And this is something that the main characters say to each other when they appear to be failing in that mantra. They throw it in each other's faces. You can tell that Baz believes it into the bottom of his soul.
He
believes it, not just because of this movie, but, you know, his production company, Bazmark Productions, that's written as a crest across every movie that he does opens with his crest, and it says, a life lived in fear is a life half lived.
That's amazing.
All the way up now into, you know, into even his current work. And I think that's so gorgeous.
It is gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, that's how I was inspired after this film. Like, I don't want to be a gutless wonder.
Right.
I want to be a person who risks. If I want to, you know what, if my body's telling me to do these weird, crazy moves, and people are saying, no, don't do that, I need to see where that takes me. I need to see what's going to come of that.
Yeah. I mean, I know we've brought up the Fincher film Fight Club in probably like three or four different episodes at this point. And it's such an interesting film. And I think I even mentioned last episode that it's a film that I saw. I knew that it had changed me in a certain way because it made me look at something. Now, I know that at the core of it, I'm not personally on board with the philosophy of Fight Club, even though I find it to be a really interesting thing. With Baz Luhrmann, he seems to be banging the same drum over and over, and it's something I actually do believe
in.
And that's something where every time I hear a character say that, or every time I see the crest at the beginning of that movie, I think, he knows who I am, and he made this for me. Yeah, okay, a little cheesy that me and my wife essentially dedicated our wedding and, you know, in the early years of our relationship to Baz Luhrmann.
Baz production.
It was, but I don't regret it, man, because I think that more people could stand to take a cue from Baz Luhrmann.
I think so, too. I mean, how many times do other people live this life of boredom because they're really afraid of trying something that actually is a risk to take, but they want to take it? But they feel all this opposition, whether it's internally, whether it's because they see other people saying, no, don't do that, that's not safe. And I don't really think you get to know who you are if you don't take risks like that.
Right.
Like Scott got to know who he was, right? Because he tried out his own moves. And he realized by trying them and by needing another person to help him, he couldn't do it alone.
Yeah.
And I think that's a beautiful thing in all of his films, is there's this sense in which people can't do it alone. you need these other people, and they might not always end in the happiest of places, but certainly they're not lives half lived.
Right. I do want to mention his specific technique and craft, because to me that's very, very integral to what he's doing. We've talked about the editing. The editing it's a marvel, really. I mean, I think it's safe to say that it is incredible what he does editing wise. He has so many edits.
Right.
He loves reaction shots.
Mm-hmm.
He loves close-ups, and he loves wide-angle close-ups. I mean, he completely goes for it. He wants as much information hitting you at any given moment as possible. And it's really interesting. Like, you know, given a certain filmmaker, there may be a dialogue scene or something like that. They'll shoot it, you know, as a master, and then, you know, you'll move in, and maybe for a sentence or two, you'll see the speaker. Maybe during the next sentence, we'll cut over to the person who's listening. Baz Luhrmann, forget it. Sometimes he starts with the reaction.
Oh, yeah.
And then he'll go to another reaction, and then the environment, and a wide, and a close, and a wide, and a close, and a medium, and then every so often, you know, he'll punch in on the person who's actually talking. Yeah. But maybe it's for like three words or something like that. And then he'll move somewhere else because he's just like, I want you to see everything at once. Yeah. And I don't know how else to do this other than to just cut like crazy. And with other filmmakers, it would annoy the shit out of me. It really would. But he has a way of doing it where you're just like, man, he likes the first third of his movies to just go edit crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And then he'll slow it way down.
He does slow it way down.
But man, that first third, you're going to go for a ride.
That's true. I mean, it feels true maybe of even the camera. The camera's constantly zooming in over and over and over on the different faces, and it'll even cut to a wide shot that goes into a face or a reaction. And then in those moments when he needs to slow down, he does. As much as there are parts of the film that annoy me, I know he's doing things intentionally.
Yeah.
He's not just like, I'm just going to put this shit together and kind of see what happens. No, and that's where it goes back to your point. I'm either going to follow him, I'm going to be in it, or I'm not going to be in it.
Yeah.
But he's making the decisions because he knows what he's trying to do. And then you also have this style of acting that I think he gets from his characters too.
Yeah.
That I'd say is a directing technique.
Yeah.
I don't know how that would actually work as a director if you're saying, no, like give me more or a higher register. But there is a sense in which all of his characters are acting at a higher register than I think other films.
Yeah. And it is a lack of naturalism, but reaches a sort of pseudo-naturalism by the time he's sort of wrapping up his second act. But he directs the arc of even the acting, which is really impressive. Now, he does a thing, and I wanted to bring this up, that I find extremely interesting. He uses slow-mo in a really specific way. Now, Baz Luhrmann is clearly not the only director to use slow-mo to be like, look at this, this is important or something. But he does a thing that I've seen other directors do, but Baz Luhrmann is the only one that, in my opinion, is actually able to do successfully. I'm going to get a little bit technical on you for a minute. There are good ways and bad ways to do slow-mo. You want to shoot slow motion by doing what's called overcranking the footage. Now, what that means is if you're sitting in a film theater, you're seeing 24 frames a second. When you're shooting, that means, you know, you're capturing 24 frames every second. Now, when you overcrank the footage, that means you're grabbing way more frames than 24, so that when you play it back at 24 frames a second, you see everything sort of decompressed and you see that slow motion and it's completely fluid and all this kind of stuff. That silky look for slow-mo, that's how that's done. Now, particularly 10, 15 years ago plus, the equipment wasn't necessarily, it was expensive. To do that.
Because you're burning a lot of film.
You're burning a lot of film, or even if you are shooting digitally, then you would have to get a special kind of camera. And not only that, even if you have all that stuff, lighting for slow-mo is a whole different thing. And so, you know, there's just a lot of complications. Needless to say, it can be an expensive proposition. So you will see a lot of freshman films, a lot of first-time directors, a lot of low-budget films. What they will do instead is they'll just shoot something regularly and they'll take it back into editing. They'll slow it down there. Well, the problem with that is essentially what you have to do is because you can't just invent frames, you have to start doubling up frames. Mm-hmm. And it has a certain look to it. It's got this sort of stuttered, stair-steppy look, and you're just like, all right. It drives me bananas. You know, people go on and on and on about the genius of Reservoir Dogs. And yes, I agree. It's a great film. Those slow-mo shots, I think, look like shit, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I can barely watch it because I know that Tarantino wanted to do something. He wanted smooth slow-mo. I can just tell that he wanted it, right, but he didn't get it. Mm-hmm. Baz Luhrmann slows down his footage in post. He doesn't go in for all this, I'm going to overcrank or anything like that stuff. And you can see it's that sort of stuttered and all that kind of stuff. He does bad slow-mo, but somehow it looks right, and I can't figure out why what he's doing.
You don't know why.
I don't know why, and he still does it. He still does it. You see it. I mean, even as recently as The Get Down.
Right.
You see it in Strictly Ballroom, like, you know, the moments where you see Scott Hastings sliding across the floor, and it's bad slow-mo, mm-hmm. but it's just like, oh, but it's part of the stylization, and it works somehow. And if somebody can explain to me why it works for Baz and no one else, then I'm all ears, but it just does.
There are probably more, but I'm thinking of two slow-mo scenes in Strictly Ballroom. One at the beginning, right, when he's doing his new moves, and he's doing the spin thing, and then when he slides across the floor, it's also cut with people's reactions that I'm wondering if, because he's not sustaining it for a long period of time,
yeah,
if it feels like it works. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I think part of it is you see this a lot in Moulin Rouge. I think he kind of likes motion blur, and I think he doesn't mind us focusing on that. Well, motion blur is something that, you know, a lot of directors kind of want to hide from mm-hmm. us, but I think he sort of loves it. He loves that blend of color or something. Maybe that's what he's intentionally doing. Maybe he saw it. Maybe he didn't have a lot of money and he did it that way in Strictly Ballroom and then decided, you know what? I like how that looked. I'm just going to keep it. I don't know.
I think that it kind of goes with what we've talked about before, where he's not afraid of people knowing they're watching a movie.
Yeah.
That there was actually technique involved.
So what does Baz Luhrmann do that maybe wasn't quite so effective in Strictly Ballroom?
Probably around the hour mark, I felt it dragged a little bit. It's when he starts to slow the film down. He's needing to learn this dance with the family and paired with this frenetic energy that kind of leads us to that. A little bit forced, maybe a little bit unnecessary. It didn't feel really Baz Luhrmann-ish. One of the things I think that didn't work also for me in this film, the edits to the close-ups on the face paired with, this is going to sound really silly, but the loudness of things, like even the character's loudness, the color, just even like those moments didn't seem to fit so well in this film that I think fit better in his later films.
In the sense that you felt like it was overwhelming or something else?
No, like it was overwhelming. And maybe it was because I wasn't expecting it or I don't know, but I thought that you have, and I'm thinking specifically of the opening sequence, where you have Scott dancing with Liz, his partner at that point, and you have the cuts to mom and the yelling and the kids. I felt like there's an energy here that I wasn't necessarily ready for or kind of brought into that I feel like he does better later. Like there's almost like a sense in which he allows me to be pulled into that later on, where I felt like it was a barrage in this sense, in this film.
Yeah, no, that's, I see what you're saying. You know, for me, it was very fluid. The journey that he wanted to take me on, I felt it pretty much the whole way. Honestly, there was really only one thing that I felt in the film that was kind of a head scratcher, I guess, if anything. He does a thing at the beginning of the film where he sets it up like he's going to, like it's a mockumentary.
Oh, yes. That's a good, I had a question about that too.
A lot of the, you know, the device that he uses is he cuts away to interview style footage of some of the main characters, and they're sort of introducing themselves and they're giving backstory and stuff. And this goes on for, I don't know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, where we're cutting back and forth between the main story and this interview footage. And then it's completely abandoned.
Totally.
And you just never really see it again. And, you know, it sort of sets you up for, okay, it's one of these kinds of movies. Yeah. And then there went that. You know, I don't think he would do that anymore because I think it's just because it doesn't feel intentional.
He doesn't, right? I mean, I don't think there are any even interview parts of any of his films, right?
No, and I you know, I was looking through his other films and like how they open, and it is this thing, this part is consistent where he doesn't really just start the story and then start telling the story. Every single film that he's ever done, he uses some sort of device to give you backstory. Mm-hmm. And in Strictly Ballroom, it was this interview footage where you hear, okay, this is what Scott's career has been like so far. And Romeo and Juliet, clearly it's built into to the script. Right. You hear the prologue. We also have the device of Romeo walking around with his diary and Moulin Rouge. It opens up Ewan McGregor. There he is. And he's typing out his own mm-hmm. story, and it's all, he's looking back on his life and he's depressed and he's, you know, he's narrating it. Australia is sort of narrated by the little boy character, and he's telling you that, you know, this is how Australia came to be, and it's the sort of motion mm-hmm. graphics thing on into Great Gatsby, where you've got right. Tobey Maguire talking to his shrink about, you know, how he came to know Gatsby and well, frankly, even on into the Get Down. So he's always got this device where he feels like you need backstory, and he's going to start with that. I think he does that least successfully in Strictly Ballroom. So honestly, everything else would just be a quibble. I thought it was just such a beautifully done movie. That was the only chink in the armor that I saw.
Yeah.
Do you have like a favorite moment or most powerful character or anything like that that just really, really hit you that you haven't mentioned?
In Strictly Ballroom?
Yeah.
I loved his father.
I love his dad. I wanted to. That's the whole reason I asked the question.
So one of my favorite moments is that whole sequence when it does this weird hyper realized theater sequence, right? Where it's just so bizarre. It feels like almost he's like Dracula, kind of
cartoonish. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so awesome. I love that moment.
The dad became, I don't know, self obsessed, focused on himself, a selfish dancer. I didn't know what to make of it. He started doing his own thing. Improvising. Filming in crazy, wild, crowd-pleasing steps. A bit like yourself, Scott. But always Strictly Ballroom.
I think it's great that it was done in this sort of cartoonish, stylized way. Which, by the way, they did it that way because of budget concerns. They wanted to tell it more straight.
Really?
But they had no money left to tell the story in that way, so they said, let's just do it on a stage with a smoke machine. But it works so well because, as you find out later, that story is a lie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's perfect that it just has this kind of fakeness to it mm-hmm. anyway. So
I love the connection that he has with his dad. I wanted to see his dad dancing more often.
Oh, and yeah.
I think I was rooting for this, and I never saw, as I wanted Scott to see his, I wanted Scott to catch his dad dancing. And he, you know, and I was hoping for that moment when he's with Fran that they would actually look in and see his dad dancing in the middle of the
yeah.
of the dance school. So I mean, I he's probably one of my favorite characters.
I think he made the movie. I mean, well, a lot of things made the movie, but my heart gets the biggest when I look yeah. back on the moments with his dad. I mean, really, honestly, I think both of the dads are the characters that stole
yeah.
my heart the most. But yeah, without a doubt. I mean, from the very first moment that you hear, "Son, can I bend your ear for a tick?"
I know.
And he brings it around finally, and it's just it's one of my biggest swollen heart moments. Is when Scott at the end says, "Not now, Dad," and he says, "No, now."
Yeah.
You know, and he says, "You have to listen to this." But that moment when, you know, when Scott is walking out onto the stage in front of, you know, however many tens of thousands of people.
When?
Son, it was the dancing that mattered.
He doesn't know what he's talking about. It's your day. Your day. Get out there.
We should have put that above everything else. We had the chance, but we were scared. We walked away. We lived our lives in fear.
It's and the clapping.
Yeah, the clapping.
The clapping.
It's, you know, feeling
my God, the clapping.
Feeling the rhythm.
He's out there and he's just nothing. He's out to sea and he's just a lone buoy in yeah. the middle of the Pan Pacific. And sure enough, Dad starts clapping. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful things
it really is.
In film,
and
really.
And he comes out of that. He walks through the crowd.
Yeah.
Clapping his hands.
Yeah.
I wanted to clap.
Yeah, and the look on his face and the whole thing, just, you know, just a broken man who's giving the only thing he has left, which is his two hands clapping to his son. I love it.
Yeah, it's so good.
You know, not a lot of films from Baz Luhrmann.
No.
So it's probably an easier question than we usually have. It's worth asking, where does Strictly Ballroom fit in the overall body of work of Baz Luhrmann?
So of the four I've seen, I'm going to put it three. So yeah. I have a number. It's easy to have a number.
Yep.
The first three are going to be Romeo and Juliet.
Is the best.
That's for me. Yeah. Maybe nostalgia, but I don't know. I just love that film. And I have so many impressions of that movie. And I've seen it actually within the last few years to still, I think, have a good opinion about it. Then I'd go Moulin Rouge. That's probably especially nostalgia because I haven't seen that as recently. Then Strictly Ballroom. And then I'll go with Great Gatsby. I don't know where Australia would fit, but that's probably my order.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And mine is somewhat similar. I'll count them down.
Oh, here we go.
I'm tempted to kind of say possibly The Great Gatsby may come in fifth.
Okay.
It's so beautiful that it's, you know, it's hard to even say that. But
right.
I think he did really well with it. Critics slammed it. Audiences didn't care. I thought that was unfair. I thought it was actually really well done. Australia was the Baz Luhrmann film for people that don't like Baz Luhrmann. He
tried to do something different.
I think he tried to. It's easily his safest, most mainstream. It's big and it's sweeping and it's gorgeous, gorgeous mm-hmm. film. Just from a pure aesthetic standpoint, it's absolutely wonderful. It's just a very safe movie. So you know, I don't really have any problems with mm-hmm. it. It's just I feel like The Great Gatsby was a little bolder, but. Third place, I would put Strictly Ballroom.
Okay.
I just love the movie so much. Yeah. I don't know what else to say. Second place, I think I would say Romeo and Juliet.
Okay.
As much as I loved and was obsessed by it earlier, I can't deny that Moulin Rouge, I think, actually upped the ante even more. Whatever critics and audiences thought, it was an event.
Yeah.
When that was made, it was this lightning in a bottle thing. I still sit and I look at that film and I say, how does a person direct something like that? I can't even begin to imagine how that was made. The vision that it took to put that together, it's beyond me, really. And I think that has to earn the top spot.
I think it revitalized, I mean, musical cinema in some way.
You know, the year after, Chicago came right. out. And of course, that won the Oscar for Best Picture, which, you know, great. And it was a well-done movie. It did stick in my craw a little bit because I thought it's a lesser Moulin Rouge.
Yeah.
And it just felt like audiences were like, yeah, calm it down a little. Yeah, that's what we right. like. And that kind of annoyed me. I'm like, no, go big or go home. Moulin Rouge. This is the movie.
So given what we've talked about in this film, do you think this is a film people should see? Or is it something that only those who really nerd out on films... You maybe like Baz Luhrmann, so you should probably watch it. Where do you think it lands in that?
I'm going to say 100% absolutely drop what you're doing and see Strictly Ballroom. It is a beautiful, fantastic, wonderful film, and it's worth your time. It's worth a viewing. It's worth repeat viewings. It's a film that we're lucky to have in the world. I can't recommend it enough. I think it's the birth of not just a great filmmaker, but it's a new way of doing. It was a new way of doing film. Yes, see it.
I think you should see it as well. And this is coming from someone who finds parts of the film not so much off-putting as distracting. I'm not coming to this film saying, oh, I love everything about it. There are certain parts of the film I'm like, oh, you know, I don't know how I feel about that. But I still think that people should see it. It is, as Jeremy said, the birth of a filmmaker. And I'd say, I wish we would have had this podcast before I watched the film to hear you, Jeremy, say, you know what? Leave the cynicism behind. Go for it all in, because then you'll be in for a real treat. And I think that's actually true. Let it say what it wants to say in the way it wants to say it. You'll be rewarded. Yeah, it doesn't play it safe.
No. Well, that's all for this episode of The Freshman 15. We want to thank you for joining us. Daniel and I agree. See Strictly Ballroom. He probably doesn't have the passion for it that I have, but I think we can, we're both saying yes, we're nodding. See the film. Watch all of the, Daniel, watch Australia. I think you'll be glad you did.
I will. I'll watch it. If you want to reach us and tell us what you think of this episode of the podcast, you can find us at Facebook, Instagram, or you can drop us a line at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. And again, this episode, Strictly Ballroom, we're doing it because people said we should do it. So we really take your suggestions to heart. So if you have a film you want us to talk about, drop us a line. we will seriously consider that.
True, true. And of course, we can't end things without mentioning our friends at Steelcraft. Born of a desire to see people come together over food and drinks, Steelcraft unites local eateries with a communal dining space in Long Beach. For more information, visit steelcraftlb.com.
Thanks again for listening. I'm Daniel Long.
And I'm Jeremy Bear.
And don't forget, a life lived in fear is...
life half lived.